Good afternoon, everyone. If you weren't paying attention to the name, there's people looking at the bulletin saying, Mike Snyder just got a lot better looking from last week. I should be careful. Mr. Snyder will have the last word when he comes up. I should thank Mr. Snyder for agreeing to switch and apologize in advance with all of the weather ups and downs. I've had a lot of sinus difficulties over the last couple weeks and had a really dry cough, so Mr. Snyder agreed to switch. Hopefully I won't hack around too much. Instead of planning on drinking his water, I brought my own too, so pardon me for the frequent drinks. The majority of us spend far more time than we realize thinking about job changes that we'd like to make. Jobs that would have different skills, jobs that would be a better fit, jobs that would have more or less responsibility. But now, the irony is that in many cases, we're thinking about job changes that we wish would happen for other people, not job changes we'd like to make ourselves. This can easily happen in lots of settings. At work, as we observe how others behave, at home with our family and loved ones, in places of business, like the grocery store or the BMV, and yes, even here in God's church. When this happens, how is it that we can feel so certain that we know what would be a better way for another person to be handling their responsibilities? John Pollard, a former governor of Virginia in the 1930s, quipped that executive ability is deciding quickly and getting somebody else to do the work. And under that definition, we all have a bit of executive ability and the views that we can so easily form on how other people ought to be doing their jobs. This tendency is present whether or not things are going well for us and whether or not the person that we're mentally evaluating is doing a decent job or not. But isn't it all the easier to critique the capabilities of someone else whenever things aren't going well for us? Somehow, when we experience difficult or unpleasant things, our capability to determine what would be better for other people to be doing seems to automatically increase. And this is especially true, of course, in cases where the person that we're evaluating is having a negative or a perceived negative impact on us. Our powers of perception work a special kind of overtime when we feel threatened in some way. And that often leads to all sorts of conclusions about the jobs that others are doing or not doing and what they should be doing instead. And sometimes our conclusions can be pretty accurate, but at other times they can be pretty far off base, can't they? In most cases, the truth lies somewhere in between our perceptions and reality. Regardless of whether we draw the right conclusion or not, what's behind this human tendency? What drives this all-too-common behavior of assessing and critiquing and often criticizing the work that others do? In the time that we have remaining, let's examine three of the main drivers for this tendency to be kind of self-appointed performance evaluators for the work that others do. And after discussing each of the three drivers, will also highlight one biblically instructed response we should train ourselves to have every time we find ourselves focused on the shortcomings in someone else's handling of their work and responsibility. The first driver that causes us to evaluate others' work is pride. Pride. There are a number of meanings and applications for the word pride. In relation to this topic, we'll discuss pride in its basic negative application toward an individual, which Merriam-Webster defines as simply inordinate self-esteem or conceit. So pride drives us to evaluate others on the basis of what we think they should be doing, rather than on an unbiased view of their responsibilities. As the unspoken reasoning often goes in our heads, we know exactly what should be happening, and maybe even how to accomplish it, so we're in a perfect position to recognize all the ways that someone else is doing it wrong. Let's look at three examples of this in the Bible. See some pride-based performance reviews from the Scriptures. The first example, let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 15, 2 Samuel 15. We'll start in verse 1. 2 Samuel 15, verse 1. After this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. So Absalom, David's son, has this big motorcade, a lot of bodyguards, kind of like the Secret Service of the time. So there's some early signs here that pride might be involved as the story takes off. Verse 2. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" He would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Now, there may well have been a problem with access to the king's deputies. You know, long queues at the courthouse are hardly a modern-day phenomena. But regardless of that, Absalom was clearly seizing whatever opportunity he had to build himself up with critiques on what he saw as the king's lackluster job performance in this area. And since the king wasn't doing things right, there was, of course, only one conclusion and alternative in Absalom's mind, which we see in verse 4. Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, and then I would give him justice." So it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. So within the full context of Absalom's relationship with David, there were multiple things driving this plot to supplant his father. One very effective mechanism that Absalom had found for working toward that end was to criticize how his father was handling the responsibility of being king. Matthew Henry's commentary says of Absalom, quote, "To gain the power he aimed at, he endeavored to instill into the people's minds, one, a bad opinion of the present administration, and two, a good opinion of his own fitness to rule." And isn't that what has sadly become normal as the tried and true formula for political elections within our country and many others? Haven't we seen the same formula at the heart of many of the divisions within God's church over the past several decades? And aren't we all guilty of thinking the same way at times when we take it upon ourselves to judge the performance of others? So one example there to look at. Let's look at a second example in 2 Kings. 2 Kings 5, the story of Naaman. 2 Kings 5, starting in verse 1. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. The Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. Then she said to her mistress, "If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy." Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus said the girl who is from the land of Israel." Then the king of Syria said, "Go now, I will send a letter to the king of Israel." Verse 7. And it happened, when the king of Israel read the letter, that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." Verse 8, so it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So the king of Israel here appears to have been a little bit confused about what his own job was. He doesn't have the presence of mind to remember that there were servants of God in his kingdom who could respond to the request from the king of Syria better than he could. Fortunately, Elijah hears about this situation, and since he wasn't confused about what his own job was, he was able to take action. Now, this seems a little humorous and silly from our perspective in hindsight, but in truth, again, when we're honest, how often do we act a bit like the king of Israel due to pride? We've all had times when someone comes to us with a request that really isn't our responsibility, but still we feel compelled to answer, compelled to act in some way just because we've been asked. Often we need to step back for a moment and ask ourselves whether there's really someone else that we should be directing the person making the request to. Continuing on then with the story in verse 9. Then Naaman went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. But Naaman was furious. He went away and said, "Indeed, I said to myself, you will surely come out to me, stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place, and heal the leprosy. Are not the Abana and the Parpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the rivers in Israel? Could I not wash in those and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. So Naaman gets really bent out of shape, here as the saying goes, when he encounters what he feels is this unusual and unprofessional interaction with Elisha. And again, when we evaluate others based on pride, we're sizing them up based on what we feel they ought to be doing, not necessarily on what they actually should be doing. So ironically, Naaman's pride was putting him at risk for missing out on being healed. He was so focused on his expectations about what he thought was going to happen that he's lost sight of why he came, and he's about to lose the opportunity to have his desire fulfilled. Continuing in verse 13, "And his servants came near and spoke to him and said, 'My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, "Wash and be clean"?' So he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him, and he said, 'Indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel.'" So fortunately, Naaman's servants were doing their jobs well, and without the bias of pride, they helped him to gain some perspective so that he could ultimately receive the healing that he had requested. Have you ever noticed how sometimes it's the person helping the person in charge who actually has the common sense and the discernment to determine what response or what action would be best in the moment? Those of us who are husbands realize that our wives play this role from time to time as helpmeets when we're a little bit blustery and overreactive, as Naaman was. Matthew Henry describes what had happened in this incident, saying, "Naaman talked himself into such a heat that he turned away from the prophet's door in rage, ready to swear he would never have anything more to say to Elisha. And who then would be the loser? Proud men are the worst enemies to themselves and forego their own redemption." So, happily for Naaman and to his credit, he did have the humility to hear this advice from his servants and to reconsider. And hopefully we also do that when we find ourselves making this kind of snap judgment about others. Let's go for a third example to the New Testament in Luke chapter 6. An example from the life of Christ. Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. "Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went in through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. Some of the Pharisees said to them, 'Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?' Verse 6, "Now it happened on another Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught. and a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and Pharisees watched him closely whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. Now, by this time in Jesus' ministry, the Pharisees and the scribes had moved beyond kind of suspiciously sizing him up, and they had become openly adversarial in many cases. Once again, much of this was based on this proud reliance on the expectations of rabbinic, not biblical, tradition and legalism. In short, they felt completely confident that if someone claiming to be a teacher didn't follow their regulations in every detail, then that person wasn't of God. And based on this, they had no problem passing swift and harsh judgment on Jesus' job performance. In fact, they probably felt like it was their duty to judge him in this fashion, and they took pride in their own job well done. Now, of this incident in the field, William Barclay writes, "It is most significant that they were watching Jesus and his disciples as they passed through the cornfields. Clearly, they were spying. And from now on, every act of Jesus' life was to be scrutinized by those bleak and critical and hostile eyes." And this was, of course, immediately true in the incident of the healing that followed, where the scripture says openly that they were watching him closely, that they might find something to accuse him of. We must, in every case, be careful to avoid this passing prideful judgment on the work that others do. Just like the scribes and Pharisees of Jesus' day, we can so easily find ourselves immersed in the negative attitudes and harmful actions that are sure to follow a viewpoint that is, as Barclay described it, tarnished by bleak and critical and hostile eyes. Humility is the consistently effective antidote for pride, and we should much rather strive for that viewpoint when we observe the work and efforts of others. The second driver, then, that causes us to evaluate others' work is pride's twin brother, anger. Anger has a more straightforward definition, fewer meanings than pride. Merriam-Webster defines it as a strong feeling of displeasure and usually of antagonism. This displeasurable feeling is clear enough. Antagonism refers really to the active expression of that feeling in hostile words or actions. Anger drives us to evaluate others based on decisions they made or actions they've taken that, as the definition indicates, have resulted in negative or antagonistic feelings for us. And as we know, anger is often a very reactive emotion, so it often results in very reactive assessments or judgments with regard to others. Let's look at two examples of this and see some anger-based performance reviews in the Bible. Let's go first back to Genesis 4. Genesis 4. We'll begin in verse 1. "Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, 'I have acquired a man from the Lord.' Then she bore again, and this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was the keeper of the sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. In the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell." So here we have Cain's reaction of anger. Clearly, he was feeling pretty intense displeasure toward God, who had rejected his offering, and toward Abel, whose offering had been accepted. The Barnes commentary notes on verse 5 point out that Cain's anger was an external manifestation of, quote, "a feeling of resentment and a sense of condemnation." Anger does often expose other emotions, such as resentment, that are underneath the surface. And in the case of evaluating what others do, it so happens that with Satan's influence and human nature, at work and our interactions with others, feelings of ill will often do get generated just in the normal course of interacting with others. How many times do we allow ourselves to become too focused on having been wronged or offended or injured in some way by another person's poor performance? Or as in Cain's case, by another person's positive performance when our performance wasn't what it should have been. Dwelling on such things creates this large, unguarded weak point in our spiritual defenses. And resentment then comes right in to take up residence before we even know what's happened often. Verse 6, continuing, "So the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it.' Now Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him." The Irish-American writer Malachy McCourt said that resentment is like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die. And unfortunately, resentment became the gateway to physical antagonism for Cain. Very sadly, he decided not to wait. He took matters into his own hands. And the tragic outcome of this example should be a powerful reminder for us of the caution that we should exercise in evaluating others based on anger. Let's go to another example in 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 25, an example from the life of David. The story of Nabal and Abigail. Starting in verse 2. "Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings." Verse 4. "When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, he sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, 'Go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him, Peace to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers, your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while that we were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come to you on a feast day." And we're hungry, by the way. "Please give whatever comes to your hand to the servants of your son David." So when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David, and waited. So David, of course, had been in this very precarious position, living in the wilderness chased by Saul. And being fugitives, they were somewhat literally kind of eking out this day-to-day existence by whatever means they could. Now, they certainly had not been hired by Nabal to do anything, but they were in proximity to all of his material resources with his flocks, and they had shown restraint by not taking anything, and they had also provided a valuable service of protection. So now David is basically sending his men to go hat in hand to Nabal and request some kindness and generosity in return to help meet their needs. Verse 10. "Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, 'Who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away, each one from his master.'" He knew David's story a bit. "Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men when I do not know where they are from?" So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words. Then David said to his men, "Every man gird on his sword." So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went with David. Now, Nabal's evaluation of David was motivated by pride and the obvious feeling that he has no need and no reason to pay attention to David's request. But David's evaluation of Nabal was motivated by anger. So even though Nabal's response was wrong, David's own reaction wasn't any less wrong. As the old saying goes, two wrongs don't make a right. And things were about to spiral out of control quickly and tragically. Verse 14. Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the field." Verse 18. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seeds of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins. Sounds kind of like the Very Hungry Caterpillar, if you remember reading that to your kids. She loads all this food onto the donkeys, and she said to her servants, "Go on before me. See, I am coming after you." Now, neither Nabal or David were putting in a very good performance in this incident. But happily, similar to the servants of Naaman who had helped him to choose more wisely, Abigail was doing her job well. And as a result, David was also blessed with the opportunity to reconsider. Verse 23. Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground. So she fell at his feet and said, "On me, my lord, on me let this iniquity be, and please let your maidservant speak in your ears." So she makes this very elegant and common sense speech, asking David to reconsider what he's about to do. And then she concludes in verse 30. "And it shall come to pass, when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good that he had spoken concerning you, and has appointed you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant." Verse 32. Again, happily, as Naaman did, David has the good sense to reconsider. "Then David said to Abigail, 'Blessed is the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed, from avenging myself with my own hand.'" So the expositor's commentary points out from David's response that he understands that God has used Abigail to keep him from this bloodshed and attempting to avenge himself. It's vital for all of us to recognize what anger can lead us to and to recognize the tremendous consequences that retaliation and vengeance and the other responses that anger drives can have. It's also very good to remember that we are all guilty of poor performance in our own roles from time to time or of inappropriate responses to others, as Nabal was. Let's highlight that in Ecclesiastes 7. In Ecclesiastes 7, there's one of those very pointed reminders to kind of look at yourself and reconsider before you think too hastily about others. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 21. "Also, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times, also, your own heart has known that even you have cursed others." We've all been in this position, right? Realizing that we've done exactly the same thing that someone else had done that hurt us. So when we feel justified in responding harshly to others who aren't performing well, we should back up and remember how we want to be treated when we've made the same mistakes. Now, there is actually a very good example of exercising restraint and reaction just a bit earlier in David's life during the incident where he had an opportunity to kill Saul in the cave. Very ironically, this seems to have happened just a very short time prior to the encounter with Nabal and Abigail. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 24. 1 Samuel 24. Starting in verse 1. It says, "Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, 'Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi.' Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs, and David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. Then the men of David said to him, "This is the day which the Lord spoke to you. Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you." And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now, it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. Now, in this encounter, David did demonstrate some pretty remarkable restraint, even when he must have felt a tremendous amount of justifiable anger towards Saul's conduct as king. David had been in a much more difficult position than simply having a boss with a hot temper, as you might have at work. Saul literally had this personal vendetta against David, and he intended to kill him. What motivated David to exercise this level of self-control? How was it that he was able to act with integrity and mercy instead of responding to Saul's violent behavior by retaliating with violence? Verse 11, when Saul had come out of the camp and David was speaking to him, he said, "Moreover, my father, see, yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, know and see that there is neither evil or rebellion in my mind. And I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my life to take it. Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you." So David was here exercising one of the best options we have for responding to a situation where someone isn't doing their job correctly, to let God handle it. He did take action. He had removed himself from the immediate danger of Saul's violence, but then he waited to see what God's expectations were for him. When we have someone whose performance is negatively impacting us, it's very easy to want to somehow engineer that person's removal and kind of get them out of the situation. But that's rarely our place, just as it wasn't David's place in the case of Saul, and he recognized that. So there are a few key points that we can summarize from this example to kind of help articulate the proper approach when we're struggling with a situation where anger is a natural or even a justifiable response to someone else's work. First, it's clear that David was right and Saul was in the wrong. That's not in dispute. But despite that, David recognized that God had placed Saul in the role of king. So God had anointed David as the future king, but he had not given him the job of removing Saul from power, and David recognized that. So David's men were anxious to interpret this opportunity that they had as God's will. But David was more careful to make sure that he wasn't acting just based on his own will and what he wanted. So since he didn't have a clear directive from God, he deferred the outcome to God and placed the timing in God's hands. So in essence, he made the very difficult decision, it's difficult for all of us, to continue being in his own role and allow God to take care of Saul in the role of king. So David's restraint in this case is an excellent example to the men on both sides of this conflict and to all of us of how to handle a situation like this. He was able to maintain his own integrity by leaving it to God. So the third driver that we'll look at then that causes us to evaluate others' work is personal uncertainty. Personal uncertainty. Now, there's no small irony that in many ways, our own uncertainty within ourselves is the most significant driver of how we see others. It's a peculiar truth of human nature that the less confidence we have in ourselves, the less confidence we have in others. The more unsure of ourselves we are, the more critical we are of others as well. A maxim attributed to author and motivational speaker Hannock McCarty is that, quote, "It's not who you are that holds you back, it's who you think you're not." There's a lot of truth in that when we assess our internal struggles honestly. This uncertainty-based criticism of others is due in large part to another item that we're all familiar with from what we might call a top 10 human tendencies list, comparing ourselves with others. All the way back to the account of Cain and Abel that we reviewed earlier, we struggle at times with seeing ourselves as we truly are, but rather we tend to compare ourselves with our perception of others. It's hard to see ourselves realistically. We rely more on our perception of others and comparing with that. So let's look at one example of this and see an uncertainty-based question about a role that a person had been given in a Bible. Perhaps the clearest biblical example of this is in John 21. Let's go to John 21. John 21, and we'll begin in verse 15. John 21, 15. So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him a third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger and you girded yourself and walked where you wished, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish." This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me." So in this account, Jesus was restoring Peter, helping him to move forward from having betrayed him during the trial. He also gave him a tremendously important responsibility in caring for his people, as well as revealing to him the not-so-pleasant death that he would eventually face. So we can all imagine that Peter must have felt the incredible weight, the incredible gravity of that assignment and that knowledge. Verse 20. Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his breast at the supper and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Peter, seeing him, this disciple, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man?" Aren't we all too familiar with that question in our own lives when we're struggling with our own personal uncertainties? What about this person? We ask. What about that person? Not quite sure why God is doing this in my life. I wonder what God is doing in their life. Why is this happening to me and not to them? Why is this happening to them? Not to me. These are all natural questions, the questions that we have to handle cautiously. It's very interesting to note the manner in which Peter asks this question. It's a very different manner from some of his former interactions with Christ and the other disciples. Keep your place there in John 21, and let's go back to Matthew 26. Matthew 26, this is actually a portion of that original account that Jesus had been addressing. Matthew 26, starting in verse 31. Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered him and said, "Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble." Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." Now, in this account, notice that Peter didn't hesitate to blatantly compare himself with others and to give himself much more credit and have much more confidence in himself than the others. Jesus had been addressing the outcome of this incident directly with Peter in the account that we were reading in John, and you can flip back there. He had, of course, forgiven Peter, and then he defined the role that he wanted Peter to play as a shepherd within the people of his church. So when Peter asked this question about John, it was just after receiving these instructions from Christ. And notice that Peter's strong and brash approach was definitely changing. And he didn't make any claims about what he would do in the commission that Christ had given him or about what anyone else would do or not do. But he was still human, and he did still wonder about his role in comparison to others. And so this time, instead of a brash statement, a question, probably even a slightly timid question after the conversation that he had just been having with Christ. The New Living Translation phrases Peter's question about John as, "What about him, Lord?" And again, how many times has the same question been in our thoughts and in our hearts? What about him, Father? What about her? When we're struggling with our own uncertainties. Verse 22 of John 21, Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Jesus' answer to Peter was essentially, "Never mind about others, that's my job. You focus on doing your job." Jesus knew what he was saying because he had had to practice what he was now preaching. During that night in the garden, just after he had predicted Peter's denial, he asked Peter and James and John to watch with him while he prayed. None of them did their jobs well. None of them did the jobs that they had been asked to do. Regardless of that, Jesus focused on doing the work that he had been given to do, not on how poorly others were performing in their jobs. William Barclay's commentary on this verse summarizes the practical application of Christ's statement very well. Barclay wrote, "Let a man serve Christ where Christ has set him. As Jesus said to Peter, never mind the task that is given to someone else. Your job is to follow me." That is what he still says to each one of us. Our glory is never in comparison with other men. Our glory is the service of Christ in whatever capacity he has allotted to us. So Christ's response to Peter is the one biblically instructed response we should train ourselves to have every time we find ourselves focused on the shortcomings in someone else's handling of their work and responsibility. To refocus our efforts on doing our own jobs well. Especially when we remember that praying for and serving others, even our enemies, is a part of our job description. As Christians, it's an approach that we can really never go wrong with. You can never go wrong with the approach to just focus on doing your own job well. So in today's message, we've reviewed three of the most frequent drivers for our human tendency to assess and critique and criticize the work that others do. We've also seen from Jesus Christ's words and example that our primary response should be to focus, with God's help, on how we can do well and improve our own in our own roles and responsibilities. Let's conclude then with an encouragement that Paul had written to those who labor as bondservants, and when you really think about this in the spiritual sense, and even physically, it applies to all of us. He had written to them about the proper approach for their own work. Let's go to Ephesians 6. Ephesians 6. This is where our focus should be. It's the same as what Christ taught, and by extension, this approach should form the basis of how we view the work of others as well as our own work. Ephesians 6, starting in verse 5. "Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters, according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart, as to Christ. not with eye service, as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service, as to the Lord, and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether the slave or free. So let's focus on doing our own jobs well.